Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. With me in the studio today on Research Matters is Mike Rosner. Mike is head of the Department of Intelligent Computer Systems within the Faculty of Information and Communication Technology here at the university. No stranger to this program, Mike has also spoken to us on other occasions about the link between computer systems and language. This is clearly an important and very topical subject, which is of great interest at a variety of levels, and I'm hoping that in this short time that we have, we'll have a look at a few of those levels. Today, he's here to talk about the upcoming conference of ELRA, the European Language Resources Association, which will involve over 1,000 participants. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, nice to be here. Nice to be back.
I shall call you Mike, because I know that computer people are all very informal characters. That's all right with you.
Sure.
Before getting into a discussion about this conference, the conference itself, which is, by Maltese standards, going to be a very large one, as I was saying before, over 1,000 participants, which is quite mind-boggling. I've tried to organise conferences of 600 and 650, and I've always come away from them very exhausted. I hope that won't be the case with you. If you could perhaps talk to us a bit about language resources, what okay. they consist of, really, a definition in a way.
Okay, just to put that into perspective a little bit. So the European Language, the ELRA is the European Language Resource Association, and this conference is all about language resources, and I'll come to that later on. But let me say a few words about what we mean by language resources. I think in order to get the idea across, one has to understand the notion of language-enabled computers. We understand the notion of computers being enabled for the internet or being enabled for certain kinds of technology. When we talk about computer programs being language-enabled, what we mean is that there is some aspect of human language which they are able to assimilate and understand and use. So this might come out in terms of, for example, a machine translation program, a program which translates from one language to another, or a program which, for example, is able to understand the content of a newspaper article to a limited degree, or a program which is able to synthesize speech, or which is able to perceive the words in a spoken utterance. These are all different aspects of language enablement. Now, for those kinds of program to be put together, they have to be based on certain kinds of data, essentially. And that data has to exist somewhere, has to be collected. Language resources really are those which constitute that data. They take different forms. They can be spoken. They can be written. They can be multimodal. That's to say, they can consist of both spoken and written data. And they can also include extra information that one might add. So, for example, when we look at spoken language resources, we find different levels of labeling of the data, ranging from purely the pure physical representation of what's there, just a wave pattern, together with an indication of what the words were, together with an indication of what the particular subparts of the word, the phonemes that make that word up, together with the intonation pattern, and so on. So one can imagine it's a bit like a score of an orchestra. At different levels, we have the time running across, unifying the data. But at different points in time, one can see the data at different levels of abstraction, ranging from this very low level waveform up to the higher level understanding of what is actually going on. In addition to that, there are language resources which are collected for example, in the area of speech difficulties. So people learning sign language, we often want to look at what is going on whilst they are trying to express certain utterances. And so we also have resources for sign language and for other kinds of activity which take place alongside language. So we would include gesture, facial expression, and so on. So it's a very, very wide-ranging notion, this notion of language resources. Starting off with the basic notion of text resources, there are, in addition, these other modalities and other dimensions we have to take into consideration.
Yes, it seems such a daunting task, because obviously here you're not just dealing with lists, as you've been explaining. Even something like intonation, or you were suggesting that the computer might be able to understand at a certain level a newspaper article. If the article has a statement that is meant in a sarcastic fashion, so the computer might be taking it at face value, but you would have to understand that it wasn't actually, shouldn't be taken at face value. I mean, this kind of understanding, which sort of goes beyond...
That's difficult for a computer. But the sort of thing that it is possible to do with a computer, with newspaper articles, is, for example, you can find all the proper names. And thus you can determine that two occurrences of particular people exist in the same article. So you can build up, if you look at an awful lot of newspaper articles of, say, a certain period, you can say that person X and person Y appeared in the same article over a certain period of time, and then later on that went away. So you can say that something might have happened involving those two people during that period. And you can build a kind of map of, let's say, of what is going on amongst the people who are mentioned in the newspapers, which people are mentioned together with other people, and build a kind of picture which reflects what's going on currently in the news. One can get surprisingly accurate indications, particularly if you look at the Maltese newspapers. We've done this. And you find that the set of names is not that huge, and you get some fairly interesting correlations between who has been talking with whom about what. You can build up maps of this kind. Mm. And what's interesting also is the way they change over time. So you can build up when certain articles hit the news, certain people become prominent, and this is very much revealed in the data and in the language resources. But you have to analyse them.
So when you're looking at these resources, and you've mentioned various types, at the end of the day, why is it important? Because what are they going to be used for, really? I mean, perhaps that's a silly question, but I remember you mentioned to me when we were talking about doing this program, talking to a colleague, and he couldn't sort of quite understand why he should be bothered about it himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the import of it?
Well, there are, very roughly speaking, there are two kinds of users for these language resources. There are those who are actually trying to put the technology together. So if you are trying to build, let's say, a system which understands the words of Maltese as spoken, then you need training data to enable the system to hear the sound, see the words, and make the association between the sounds and the words, essentially. That is speech technology, and obviously that kind of data is of interest to speech technologists, people putting together the actual technology. However, there's another class of user, which really are these people are not trying to put together technology, but they would be working, for example, in the humanities. I mean, what humanities people do is they work with resources they find in libraries, and what are they working with? They're working with language resources. They're working with texts. They're working with possibly with illustrations within those texts. They might be working if they're working on speech, they might be working on how things sound. There are many things that they could be doing, but predominantly people in the humanities are working with linguistic materials. And the reason why they should be interested in language resources is, first of all, they are already interested in language resources, but maybe the resources they are using are not, at this point in time, available very easily. It would require a considerable amount of research to find where the particular piece of material they want is to be found. It may not be found in this country, maybe in some obscure obscure archive somewhere else. So it would be difficult to find it. And once it's been found, to actually get the material over could also be quite difficult. So there is some scope here for what one might call intelligent archiving of different kinds of material, and intelligent ways in which this can be accessed, indexed, made available to people, and so on. And this is why, why it's of interest to people working in all the different humanities. I mean, it's not just people who are, for example, linguists. It's also of interest to historians. It's also of interest to art historians. I mean, I had a very interesting discussion with an art historian who was telling me about she was specializing illustrated texts, illustrated manuscripts, which contain both text and illustrations. And typically, the way in which this manuscript would be classified would be to look at the picture, and you find within the picture, for example, the mention of you see images of certain saints, which would refer to certain saints which were referred to in the text. So by making the correlation between the saints which were mentioned in the text and the saints which were either implied or literally drawn in the images, this would tell you something about the origin, about the school in which it was created, and so on. So this person was in order to get her hands on the materials she uses, she now uses the internet, but it's in a very intuitive way. It's not very very well organized. And it really comes down to using email, finding a web reference here and a web reference there, and trying to put things together. Well, the claim that we would like to suggest is that we can do better than that. And by having the materials in the right place, where they would normally be, but being able to be accessed in a more intelligent way, in a more sensible way, then the productivity of the researcher could be increased. And what's more, the people who make those resources available would become better known because they've made those resources available to more people. So it's a real facilitator for carrying out research in the humanities. And when I mentioned to you that that it is difficult for people to be convinced of this. I mean, it is difficult. I mean, people who have been working in certain ways for many years wonder what more one can do with these extra tools. And I mean, it's not, you can't just tell them that it's good for them, because it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like many things technological, it takes a while to trickle through. And I mean, I think these days nobody would be seen dead not using Google, you know. But that didn't happen overnight.
But it's not just a matter of digitizing. It's not just a matter of, I don't know, I can think of our notarial archives, for example, here in Malta. Okay, you're going to, it will be nice, you know, instead of having to look through very precious, very friable pieces of paper.
Yeah.
Perhaps if it were digitized, obviously you'd be able to avoid that. But it sort of goes beyond that, because what you're saying is that you're going to be able to sort things out and make comparisons with the software
rather than just have copies of it. Yes, alongside the resources, it's possible to have tools which do analysis of different kinds. I mean, I know, in my own field, I know this best because in the field of language, for example, it's possible to, you have a, the text, I mean, the thing I mentioned just now, supposing you have the newspapers of the last 20 years sitting there. You can devise, it's very easy to write programs which will find the proper names. For instance, that's a very low level of analysis, but nevertheless, it's it is more than just the words. It's telling you who there was. And you could imagine that being linked to other archives which tell you more about those particular people and what they were doing. So the linking of the textual material via certain kinds of analysis with other material that is around is also possible. And we cannot, as you mentioned earlier on, it's very difficult for us to do, to detect irony, let's say. That's hard. But what we can do is we can do certain kinds of analysis. One can, I mean, at the level of newspapers, one can certainly look at proper names. One can do a bit more than that as well. I mean, one can also look at the relationship between the different kinds of, the different kinds of entities that are mentioned, not just people. One can look at places, one can look at lots of things. One can look at
companies.
One can look at the one can look at which people are associated with which companies. One can also look at the language itself. One can we have programs which can let's say parse the sentences and understand the linguistic structures that are being used, so we can get an idea of at a higher level of analysis. We can look at the linguistic structures that are being employed at that time. So the development of tools and the development of the resources, they kind of go together. The one doesn't really exist without the other. You usually need some tools. If you want to develop more natural sounding speech synthesis, you need to base it on naturally sounding speech. So what do? You have to take naturally sounding speech and you have to analyze it not just as a wave, but as an intonation pattern, and see how that how that can be correlated with what is being said, and hence bring that back to the models you're actually trying to build of speech synthesis. So there are tools, and I think that the tools at the moment which are available for building the technology are in a better state than the tools which are to be developed for helping humanities researchers. That's something which is coming, very much it's going to happen.
Mm. But you feel that when more people can see or be aware of the advantages, that will then in turn drive
because it requires expertise. I mean, it's no good, the technology and the technology people cannot tell the art historians what to do and say, look, here are these fantastic tools, go and use them. It doesn't work like that. It's got to be the art historians to tell us what they want. And this is a very old problem in computer science, that you've got these technologists who have these machines, they don't know what to do with them. So they ask, they just build these wonderful things that they like, and nobody knows what to do with them. It's really important that the users are able to interact with the designers to come up with something which is going to be useful, and is going to be not just useful, but is going to take them beyond what they're able to do now.
It has to be a sort of symbiotic kind of relationship where one feeds one feeds the other. Are there initiatives and activities that are being undertaken now at the moment here and abroad that you might have been involved in language research?
Well, I mean, there is actually a project, a very large European infrastructure project called CLARIN. It stands for Common Language Resource Infrastructure, and it fits into the category of European programs that are building what's called research infrastructures. These are not research projects, they are projects which allow, within which research can be done. For example, if you want to build what they have at CERN, this wonderful accelerator, that permits an incredible number of actual pieces of research to be done. Okay, so that's a research infrastructure. Now, CLARIN is about building a research infrastructure for language resources, and it involves all European countries. Such projects go through different phases. There's a preparatory phase followed by a construction phase when you actually kind of build the structure itself. During the preparatory phase, you design it. During the construction phase, you actually build it. During the last phase, when it's been built, you actually exploit it and it's going to be used by researchers. Now, we're currently in the preparatory phase of Clarin. And, I mean, we have a very tiny amount of a grant to help us to set up the basic designs. And we're involved with the design of one particular part of that project.
Let's move on to the conference, yes. The LREC conference, which is coming up in May,
yes.
Which, again, this is another little bit of a daunting task.
It is indeed. I mean, one of the most daunting aspects is, as you say, we have 1,000 people, and although there are rather few plenary sessions, there are several of them.
In fact, the only place that can actually seat everybody is the MCC,
There are very few possible places. There were two places, but that was the one we chose, mainly because this conference that's taking place, it's one of a series. It happens every 2 years. It's been in many other European centres. It tends to be, or it has been in the past, in Mediterranean region countries. So we've had Lisbon, we've had Genoa, and so on. There's been several of these. Last year it was in Marrakesh. There are many traditions associated with this conference, one of which is that it should be in a historic place. So that more or less...
Well, we've certainly fit that bill.
Out of the two possibilities, two possible locations, the MCC was the obvious one.
Yes, absolutely. And who are going to be these 1,000 participants?
Who are they going to be? Well, there's a big mixture of people. It is as you might expect, the people who are exploiting language resources come from not exclusively from universities. Obviously, at one level, there is a proportion of university people because the underlying material is the kind of material which gets studied in universities and gets elaborated in universities. However, in addition to that, there are a lot of, I think there's a 30% participation by industry. The sort of language technology industry is actually quite big because there is... When we look at the wider perspectives of what language technology is, it's clear that it enters into everyday activities increasingly. So, I mean, I mentioned Google just now. Everyone knows what Google is. Google is based on language technology. People are getting accustomed to hearing announcements at airports in a synthesized voice. That's language technology. People are used to getting more and more into social networking on the web. What's underlying social networking, besides the people who operate it, is the fact that we are able to analyze what's going on again at a certain level, and in terms of who is talking to who about what people's opinions are about certain products. There's a field of language technology which deals with opinion mining out of text. You take reviews of products and you see what people are saying about them. This is all big money, and this is why we have 30% of our people, of the participants at this conference, are coming from industry. The conference lasts for a week. There are 2 days at the beginning and the end of workshops and tutorials in different subject areas, and in the middle there is the main conference where we expect to have most of the participants, where we will have at least 1,000. It was 1,000 a week or so ago, so it's going to be more than that.
And the University of Malta's participation?
The University of Malta is. I mean, we've got some people who've put in some papers, and of course they've been extremely helpful in helping us to find the right people to be in contact with throughout the preparatory period. There's some sponsorship which we've been following, and we've been very generously sponsored by the Maltese government on this. So yes, I mean the university is there and it's present in the list of people. For a very long time, it was DG13 at the time, of the European Commission was involved with the problem of multilinguality. And multilinguality has been the driver of a large number of activities within the European Commission. One of the reasons being that they spend, I think it's 15% of their budget on translation services. So, I mean, because they have to. And it's very expensive, and they, in the 1980s, were trying to develop a multilingual translation system. So ELRA was, interestingly, was born out of, initially, a kind of very practical problem, which occurred in the part of the European infrastructure dealing with research. That, in turn, sought to develop certain kinds of technology as a, or rather, to do research into the technology in order to develop solutions. And that required, in this case, language resources. So the projects that developed the resources, which began to yield large numbers of results, it was felt there was a need to have an organization which would be responsible for these. And that's what ELRA is. And since, the very first ELREC, the ELREC is the conference of that organization. And it's broadened in its outlook tremendously. I mean, the first...
Well, it has definitely got many people, different people involved, hasn't
yes.
it, for a start?
Yes, I mean...
types of academics yes. and companies yes. and NGOs.
Yeah, everything. And everybody's involved at some level. And then you look at the range of the program. I mean, looking at the... I just had a glance before I... I should know the program off by heart, but I don't. It's too big. But, for example, there are workshops taking place in areas such as African language technology, Semitic languages, biomedical text mining, supporting of e-learning, semantic processing of legal texts, sign language corpora for research on emotion and affect. I mean, the list goes on.
Yes.
So there's a tremendous range of activities which are being covered in workshops, and they, of course, the main program. I should add that there's going to be a short slot, plenary slot, devoted to the Maltese language, at which my friend and colleague Ray Farbury will be telling people the why and the how of Maltese.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mike Rosner, for coming on Research Matters to tell us about language resources and also about this upcoming conference, and I wish you luck with this.
Thank you very much indeed.